I think the majority of Alaskans will find this sort of thing reprehensible.
A backlash after Hunter's photo of 10 dead wolves circulated online. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 6th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, scientists have a new tool to help predict how Alaska's permafrost will thaw.
We hope that this tool will be useful for engineers and also for people who live in Alaska.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
And by
Raven Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal spring routes now available to Kotzebue, Anchorage, Dillingham, and more. Information can be found at flyraven.com.
After a slow session, the Alaska legislature advanced budget proposals this week. Both the House and Senate would draw money from Alaska Permanent Fund earnings to pay for state government for the first time. I spoke with Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman about where things stand. Greetings, Andrew.
Hello, Zach.
So, Andrew, how is this budget shaping up?
Well, the House and Senate have been pretty far apart on some of the major questions facing the state. The House budget and the Senate's draft budget are pretty similar. Both would increase the portion of the budget the legislature directly controls by more than $500 million. Nearly half of those increases would go to permanent fund dividends, which would be about $1,600. And Governor Bill Walker signed off on that this afternoon.
Are there other differences between the House and Senate versions of the budget?
The Senate would spend less on government operations, and it would spend more on oil and gas tax credits. And the Senate Finance Committee made a couple of complicated changes related to school funding. They would have the effect of moving money from permanent fund earnings to the piggy bank the state has used for years to close the budget gap, which is the constitutional budget reserve. Governor Walker criticized the Senate budget for including cuts to public safety funds, including more than $2 million for troopers to travel to rural communities.
And where we are right now, it's 9 days from the end date of the legislative session or when it's supposed to end under state law. Does it look like the legislature is going to go home and finish anytime soon?
In a word, no. The Senate is looking to pass its version of the budget by then. The Senate Finance Committee heard public testimony on the budget today. But the Senate and the House will have to resolve their differences, so it will likely go on at least a few days longer. The biggest remaining question is whether the two chambers will compromise on a plan on how to use permanent fund earnings to pay for state government in the future. Permanent Fund Corporation CEO Angela Rodell says fund managers' job will be harder if they don't know what the legislature is going to do from year to year. But the two sides have so far refused to budge. The House wants to completely close the state's more than $2 billion spending cap. On top of using fund earnings, they'd add taxes on income or on the oil and gas industry. The Senate says it's enough to pass the permanent fund plan this year. Earlier this week, NOM Representative Neil Foster talked about whether he thinks the Permanent Fund Plan bill, Senate Bill 26, or putting the draw, or PFD, in the state constitution is something he must have this session. Here's Foster.
I personally don't see SB 26 or constitutionalizing as either of those being must-haves right now for us to leave here under the current circumstances without a full fiscal plan and so forth.
So that's where things stand.
And presumably there are other bills and other pieces of legislation that people would like to see passed. Any traction on any of that? Is there anything besides the budget that's made any headway this session so far?
It's interesting. Last year, the legislature set records for the most number of days in session and the fewest bills passed in Alaska's history. This year, they likely won't spend as much time in Juneau. But they're on track to break the record for fewest bills, with only 5 this year, compared with 32 last year. There are a few bills the legislature could focus on. One would use bonds to pay off oil and gas tax credits. A couple of bills are intended to help public safety. One would allow judges to use information from other states to determine whether people who've been arrested should be released before their trials. Another bill would allow the Attorney General to schedule newly available drugs as being dangerous. And there's still a possibility that the legislature could pass a bill that would allow judges to temporarily take guns from people who they find to likely be threats to themselves or others.
Okay. Well, Andrew, thanks for the update, and have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too, Zach.
That was Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman from Juneau. A public comment period on the environmental impact of the proposed Pebble Mine has been extended. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced today that it would add 2 months to its initial scoping period. Public comments during that scoping process helped the Corps decide what to focus on during the environmental review of the project. The Corps had initially scheduled a 30-day scoping period that would have ended in April. Now, people will have until June 29th to weigh in. Alaska Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Andy Mack and Senator Lisa Murkowski wrote to the Corps asking for more time. Both said the federal review process needs to include longer public comment periods, given the scope of the massive mining project. Murkowski also asked the Corps to reach out to Alaska Native corporations and expand its outreach to rural communities in the Nooshiegak River watershed who are likely to be impacted by the mine. The mine would be located near some of the richest salmon fisheries in the world. The killing of 10 wolves by a single hunter north of the Denali Highway has raised new calls for protection of the animals in the Denali National Park region. Photos of an unidentified hunter with an AR-style rifle and a snow machine surrounded by 10 wolf carcasses have circulated online. State Division of Wildlife Conservation Director Bruce Dale says the state was alerted to the February kill, which occurred on state land 70 miles east of the park, where the wolf hunting bag limit is 10.
The harvest was reported and the hides were checked in and all laws were complied with as far as the troopers were concerned.
I think the majority of Alaskans will find this sort of thing reprehensible.
Biologist and wildlife advocate Rick Steiner says the mass killing of wolves and other predators has no place in modern Alaska.
But at very least, this shouldn't be permitted anywhere near Denali National Park.
Some online comments applaud the wolf kill as a benefit to moose and caribou, and the state's Dale defends the high bag limit for wolves, citing the species' resiliency.
A pack of six can double in size with a single litter.
Dale says kills by other wolves or people disrupt packs, but also result in dispersals that lead to formation of new family groups. The 10 wolf kill occurred far from the area along Denali's northeastern boundary, recently closed to wolf harvest due to an above average take this season. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a 200-year-old tradition baked into bread.
It's kind of the way that I feel when I cook anything that's an old recipe. You just feel like you're part of something that's older than you and bigger than you.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnosis and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Since returns first came in for Anchorage's local elections Tuesday night, more than 20,000 additional ballots have been counted, and the preliminary results appear to be holding. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz maintains a 19-point lead over his main challenger. On Thursday evening, Rebecca Logan conceded the race, writing on her campaign's Facebook page that she wishes Berkowitz the best in his second term. Proposition 1, the effort to change how public restrooms are regulated, is failing. The gap between yes and no votes has remained at about 4,000 ballots, even as more returns have come in. However, opponents of the measure have not yet declared victory and are monitoring the final ballot count. One school board race between Alicia Hild and Tasha Hotch remains close, but Hild's lead has grown over the last few days. So far, the clerk's office has processed nearly 71,000 ballots and estimates there are still another 10,000 to count. State officials say a man was injured north of Anchorage after a moose that he had just kicked stomped on his foot in return. The Associated Press reports that the moose injured the man Thursday morning. State Department of Fish and Game spokesman Ken Marsh said the man escaped major injuries in the encounter. Marsh said the cow and calf were on the trail and quote, the guy was trying to go through them, end quote, when he kicked the mother. Alaska Troopers spokeswoman Megan Peters said the two moose involved left the area after the moose stomped on the man's foot. Peter advised others not to go around kicking moose. Marsh emphasized the vastly superior leg strength of a moose, saying a kicking contest with an ungulate is questionable. All infrastructure in Arctic Alaska, from roads to homes to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, rely on stable permafrost in order to be functional. And it's no secret that as the Arctic warms, that stability is being threatened. Now, researchers have put together a tool that's designed to help visualize how thawing might play out in specific places so they can better prepare for the future. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Ravenna Koenig has this report.
Vladimir Romanovsky is a permafrost researcher at the Geophysical Institute in Fairbanks. He's sitting in his office looking at a map on his computer.
So if you're interested in Barrow, you can make this map kind of blow up a little bit and then see what is the situation in Barrow.
The map is almost identical to what you'd see if you looked up the North Slope on Google Maps. But instead of the normal grays and greens, the whole region is lit up in vibrant colors, representing ground temperatures. The map allows you to see what might happen to those temperatures if, say, greenhouse gas emissions come down a bit from where they are now. In that scenario, 70 years from now, the permafrost remains frozen, in Utqiagvik at least. In another scenario, emissions stay the same, and as a result,
we see a completely change in the colors, and now we see the temperatures are all somewhere above 0 degrees Celsius, above this threshold, around plus one.
No surprise, right around the freezing point is where permafrost starts to thaw. And that's not great for the structures that rest on top of it. A few things make this map possible. One is that scientists have already mapped the ecology and geology of the North Slope in a pretty detailed way. And based on that, along with temperature data they've collected from 35 sites around the region, they can project how specific parts of the landscape might react to warming temperatures.
Say, if you have two different conditions next to each other, we can say that in this 100 by 100 feet, permafrost will behave this way, and next to it, it could behave differently.
In addition to the two different climate scenarios, you can also see how adding gravel, say for a road, or seeing an increase in vegetation might change the temperature of the ground. Romanovsky emphasizes that the map is not a prediction.
Predicting future it's a very dangerous thing. Of course, predicting to 2050 for me, it's okay. At least during my lifetime, nobody will check if it's right or not.
Instead, the map is simply a projection of how a few scenarios might play out based on different assumptions.
So we hope that this tool will be useful for engineers who are doing some projects in this area, for government thinking about what they should expect, and also for any people who live in Alaska.
He says that the North Slope is just the first region they've made a map for. Eventually, they'd like to make others for permafrost throughout the state. The project was paid for by the U.S. Geological Survey, and it will be available to the public in a few weeks. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig in Fairbanks.
Juneau emergency responders took part in a training exercise this week to test their ability to work together in the event of a large-scale threat. Part of the simulation involved responding to a nuclear bomb aboard a ferry. KTOO's Adeline Baxter rode along to get a close-up view of Operation Shielded Eagle.
Under clear skies and calm seas, the St. Nicholas takes off from the dock by the ferry terminal with 30 passengers and a handful of crew. This isn't a typical tour excursion. Today, the St. Nicholas is standing in for the Alaska Marine Highway Ferry Columbia and carrying a potential nuclear threat. Later on, members of the U.S. Coast Guard Sector Juneau and the Juneau Police Department will board the vessel. But for now, Allen Marine Tours puts out coffee and donuts for passengers who range from retirement age to college students. Despite the serious nature of the exercise, volunteers are enjoying themselves.
Like everybody said, I really want to thank you for being here. I mean, although it's a pretty nice day for a boat ride.
That's Rich Bainham with the Coast Guard Exercise Support Team. He explains that the training scenario involves a radiological device planted somewhere on the boat by terrorists. Earlier, a device emitting low levels of radiation was hidden on board. The response team will use detection equipment to locate it.
Well, your role is simply passengers, right? Somewhere in this scenario, there could be some bad guys, some bad gals, but you're not one of them.
Jack and Judy Marshall, both in their 70s, came along for the free boat trip. Their daughter told them about the opportunity.
Yeah, with all this sun and everything, it's going to be really beautiful out here. You know, a lot of mountains are white, and it should be great. Maybe see a whale or two, you know?
And they do, almost immediately. A humpback whale surfaces nearby, and passengers head for the stern with their cameras. Carolyn Garcia is on the email list for Juno's Emergency Planning Committee. She signed up as soon as they put out the call for volunteers last week.
Well, I'm interested in the drill just because I'm also a Red Cross volunteer and because I am interested in helping respond to emergencies and participate and just know what's going on as far as what the rest of the community are doing.
After a few hours spent floating offshore, a Coast Guard boat approaches. They pull up alongside the boat and board quickly, plastic guns in their holsters.
We're going to take everybody in one by one, okay? Have your IDs ready. Don't reach for them yet until we're about to take you in, okay? So we'll start from here and work back. So once you're ready, sir.
The team asks passengers to sit with their hands above their heads until they can verify their identities. It's a serious exercise, but not without light moments.
Okay, so let's all go downstairs, wait in front of the donuts, and then we'll see who's back here.
Passengers secured. The team searches the boat and locates the hidden device.
We're done with the role playing and everything, so thank you guys. Appreciate all your help.
Coast Guard Lieutenant Tim Storbeck is part of the team of coordinators in charge of the exercise. He said he was happy with the team's performance. While a terrorist scenario may seem like a remote threat for Juno, he said the point was to test response capabilities and make Juno safer.
If something major happened where we absolutely needed the police department to go out, if we hadn't practiced beforehand, for example, they don't carry life jackets because they don't have a maritime unit. So the Coast Guard had to provide life jackets for the police department. Now, we wouldn't want to find that out when we're going out to respond to some sort of a scenario.
Police Lieutenant Craig Campbell agreed. While each of the participant groups involved in the scenario conduct their own regular exercises, the chance to collaborate is invaluable.
We don't get that many opportunities to work with them like that, so this is a good opportunity for us to work together, one, to see how are things working, how is our communication.
The exercise continued Thursday, with the teams picking up right where they'd left off. Evaluators will hold a debrief to review how things went at the end of the week. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Matson, committed to the communities it serves. Building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers the Alaska Supplemental Education Loan for students attending most college or training programs in or outside Alaska. And it offers interest rates lower than the Federal Plus. For more information, call 1-800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, Easter bread. Russian Orthodox Easter is this Sunday, and families across Alaska are preparing for the event with Easter bread. The symbolic food came to the state along with Russian colonists more than 200 years ago, but it's taken on a new life with Alaskans who have since added their own traditions to it. Victoria Peterson has the story.
Scraping the sides of the bowl, Abby Slater is forming a dough of milk,
sugar, yeast, and flour. It's Slater's first time making Easter bread. She's observed and helped her Aleut family make it many times before, though.
My earliest memory of Easter bread was actually later in life, because we didn't reconnect with my aunt until I was a little bit older, and she was the one who had the recipe for the Easter bread. My grandma died before I was born, my native grandma, my Kuka, and so she didn't get to pass that along to us grandkids.
The recipe her aunt uses is the same recipe the family has been using for generations. Originally from Kashiga, a small village near Dutch Harbor, Slater's family traditionally used dried berries and candied fruits in their Easter bread.
I do feel like with Easter bread, it's interesting hearing all the different variations of it, because at the end of the day, it's just a bread recipe, right? But we talk about things like some people put berries in it or candied fruit, and that's what I grew up, that's the version I grew up with. But then other people are like, no, that's not how you make it. And then other people frost it. And in my mind, I'm like, that's not how you make it. But that is how people make it. It's just not what I grew up with, you know.
Diane Chris says that Easter bread in Prince William Sound is elaborately decorated. She's a matushka, which means priest's wife, at St. Innocent Russian Orthodox Church in Anchorage.
So on Easter, when you're in a church, I've been in the churches are small in the Sound. I've been there, and all, you know, you're fasting, and all you smell is this sweet kalich and the frostings, and it's just amazing. So, and normally they put a candle on the top of them and it's lit for the blessing. Yeah, it's very festive.
Easter bread, also known as kulich, is a decadent egg-rich, dairy-rich, yeast-risen bread. Mother Kapitolina, the only nun at St. Innocent Russian Orthodox Church in Anchorage, says the bread symbolizes Easter.
We're doing everything that we have fasted from, butter, eggs, okay, and then now it's the resurrection.
Chris helps make food for a bake sale the church is having. She says the bread is baked in coffee tins, representing the tomb Jesus resurrected from. Traditionally, Easter bread is always made by women and is a skill mothers pass down to daughters. Every year, St. Innocent has an annual bake sale where church members bake Easter bread, fry bread, piroshkis, pirog, and other traditional foods. The money from the sale goes to their church and is open to the public.
We have lots of people throughout the state that have grown up with the bread in the villages, and they have different types of bread that they're used to. So we have a variety here that are baked by the ladies of the church.
It's not just the Alaska Russian Orthodox population that enjoys the tradition of Easter bread. Chris says that St. Innocent's annual bake sale is always the Saturday before unorthodox Easter.
We try to do it prior to everybody else's Easter because they like it for their Easter. It's become a tradition for a lot of people who aren't even necessarily Orthodox.
There are over 50,000 followers of Russian Orthodoxy in Alaska and 49 parishes set up across the state. The bread is blessed on Easter Sunday by members of the Russian Orthodox Church and then shared with the congregation. Easter bread is only eaten by the Russian Orthodox between Easter and Pentecost, which is 49 days after Easter. Abby Slater isn't Russian Orthodox, but the making of Easter bread ties her to her Alaska Native family.
I feel really connected, I guess. Maybe that sounds silly because it's just bread, but I feel like I'm participating in something. It's kind of the way that I feel when I cook anything that's an old recipe. You just feel like you're part of something that's older than you and bigger than you.
For AK, I'm Victoria Peterson.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Harold Good in Kotzebue. Good is a chef at Manilook Long-Term Care Facility. When he moved to the region a year ago, he had to learn to cook in a very different way.
I've been a chef in the cooking field for about 26, 27 years, and you know, just been in it, and then our home is in Montana, so we cook deer and all that, elk and all that, so it's nothing different, you know. Cooking the traditional foods here, now seal and whale, now that's a different beast, you know, but hey, I'm willing to learn it. They received a seal, and so I helped him skin it and everything, and it was so deep, deep, deep red. And so it was rich in iron because they're just deep water fish. You know, they swim deep. And so the flavor was little irony, you know, a little bit of iron in there. But, you know, I tasted it fresh and it wasn't that bad. It was actually good. I was like, oh my goodness. But the seal oil has been a little tough one for me. And I think I might have to pass on that. You know, I mean, these elders here, I love them. You know what I mean? I mean, beautiful people, beautiful. There's a woman out there who, she doesn't say anything, but she looks so strong, you know. So I asked one of her caretakers, and she said, yeah, she used to be the breadwinner in her family, and she would go out wailing by herself, you know, just crazy. And, you know, but she looks the part. She's just a strong, beautiful Alaskan Native woman. She is, you know, so I'm very, you know, there's a couple in here like that, but she just really, every day I come in, I make sure she's okay, you know? She's something else, I feel. You know, we're in their world, and we have to, you know, I think as a chef and as a food service provider, I think it's very important that we give them within regulations what they're used to. I mean, that's food for the soul, you know what I mean?
Harold Good lives in Kotzebue. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Victoria Peterson, Ann Hellman, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rasha McChesney, Alan Baxter, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Dan Bross and Ramena Koenig in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven, Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Opioids are powerful prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication protects children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. UA is working to build Alaska's future workforce with investment in UA-educated teachers. Individuals interested in a future in teaching can apply for the President's Teach for Alaska Scholarship for degree studies at any of the UA campuses. An education from the University of Alaska is an investment in the future. Application period closes May 1st. More at alaska.edu/learn-to-teach. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.